ki jai, Navadvi Maya Pur Dham ki jai, Jagannath Puri Dham ki jai, Gangamayi Jamuna Devi ki jai, Bhakti Devi ki jai, Tulsi Maharani ki jai, Samaveta Bhakti Vrinda ki jai, Gaur Premananda. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to Sri Guru and Gauranga. All glories to Srila Prabhupada and Maha Vishnu Padaya. Krishna Prashtaya Vitalaya Sri Mate Bhakti Vedanta Swami Niti Namane. Namaste Saraswati Devi Paramipachana Vasasa Samana Pasatala Satana. Vandeham Sri Guru Sri Yutala Padakamalam Sri Guru and Vaishnavam Chan Sri Rupam Sangrajatam Sahagana Raghunatham Vitam Sam Sajivam. Sadvaitam, Sadvarutam, Purijana, Sahita, Krishna Chaitanya Devam, Sri Radha, Krishna Padam, Sahagana, Lalita, Sri Vishakam, Pitamscha. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. So it's April 15th, 2009 in Auckland, and we're reading Bhagavad Gita, chapter 14, text 1 through 13. So let's read through the translations together. Ready? The Supreme Personality of Godhead said, "Again I shall declare to you the Supreme Wisdom, the best of all knowledge, knowing which all the sages have attained the supreme perfection. By becoming fixed in this knowledge, one can attain to the transcendental nature like my own. Thus established, one is not born at the time of creation, nor disturbed at the time of dissolution. The total material substance called Brahman is the source of birth, and it is that Brahman that I impregnate, making possible the births of all living beings, O son of Bharata. It should be understood that all species of life, O son of Kunti, are made possible by birth in this material nature, and that I am the seed-giving father. Material nature consists of three modes, goodness, passion, ignorance. When the eternal living entity comes in contact with nature, O mighty armed Arjuna, he becomes conditioned by these modes. O sinless one, the mode of goodness, being purer than the others, is illuminating, and it frees one from all sinful reactions. Those situated in that mode become conditioned by a sense of happiness and knowledge. The mode of passion is born of unlimited desires and longings, O son of Kunti, and because of this, the embodied living entity is bound to material fruit of actions. O son of Bharata, know that the mode of darkness, born of ignorance, is a delusion of all embodied living entities. The results of this mode are madness, indolence, and sleep, which bind the conditioned soul. O son of Bharata, the mode of goodness conditions one to happiness. Passion conditions one to fruit of action, and ignorance covering one knowledge binds one to madness. Sometimes the mode of goodness becomes prominent, defeating the modes of passion and ignorance, O son of Bharata. Sometimes the mode of passion defeats goodness and ignorance, and at other times ignorance defeats goodness and passion. In this way, there is always competition for supremacy. The manifestation of the mode of goodness can be experienced when all the gates of the bodies are illuminated by knowledge. O chief of the Bharata, when there is an increase in the mode of passion, the symptoms of great attachment, fruit of activity, intense endeavor, and uncontrollable desire and hankering develop. When there is an increase in the mode of ignorance, O son of Kuru, darkness, inertia, madness, and illusion are manifest." No, that's it. So the modes of material nature are one of the ways in which, well, how can we put this? There are a law of material nature that exists all over the universe. So scientists are always interested in trying to find out what are universal laws. Pretty useful thing to know, right? Just like when I come from America to New Zealand, the traffic law is different. Drive on the other side of the road. So that's a useful thing to know. It's useful to know if I want to drive without getting in an accident. It's useful to know if I want to drive without getting arrested. Knowing what the laws of a place are very useful. What is the etiquette? Just like sometimes you go to another country or you visit people from another culture in your own country and you're not quite sure what the etiquette is, isn't it? Even Prabhupada describes how when he first met, maybe first or second time he met Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati, Bhaktisiddhanta was sitting down and Prabhupada sat on a chair that was on the same level. And gradually he noticed that everybody else who was coming in was sitting lower. So he said he didn't move because he was already there, but after that whenever he came in, he sat at a lower level. So we want always wants to know what are the rules, isn't it? Don't you want to know what the rules are? What are the laws? How do things work? So scientists spend a lot of time and energy trying to figure out what are the laws. Now they assume, and it's a big assumption, that the laws they discover work, first of all over this planet, in all conditions. And they also assume that those laws work all over the universe in the same way. Now those are very big assumptions because that might not be true. For example, when scientists tell you how old something is, oh, this rock is so many millions of years old, how do they know that? How do they know how old the rock is? See, I could tell you how old an apple is because I was living at the time it was picked and I'm living now. I've been living all through that time. Does that make sense? But if I'm going to tell you how old something was that came into existence before I was born, how can I tell how old that is? How do I know?
It's just an estimation.
It's an estimation. Well, I can know if I have evidence from someone who was there when it was created. And if I believe that evidence. That evidence has to exist, and I have to consider that it's truthful. So if somebody writes in stone on the corner of a building, this building was built in 1620. I generally believe that. But they might be lying. Do people sometimes lie about those things? Oh, sure they do. They create something and they say it's very old and actually they artificially aged it just to say it was an antique. So, yeah, how do I know how old something is if I wasn't there when it was created? And suppose nobody has a record of when it was created. You find a rock lying around with a fossil in it. There's not usually an inscription in it. This fossil was created at this and this time. How do you know? So they say, well, we can judge in our lifetime how fast something ages. Or maybe over the lifetime of two or three scientists. You could watch how fast something ages. How fast does a rock age? And then you can say, well, we're going to guess that the rock ages at the same rate. So that if it keeps aging at the same rate, then it will be X number of years old. Are you all following my logic? But do we know whether or not rocks age at the same rate over millions of years? We don't know that. The rate may change. Who is going to hang around for millions of years to observe? We don't know. So we don't know if the laws that scientists tell us are laws are really true everywhere on the planet and are really true for all time. And of course, often they find that they're not. They'll come up with some, they'll observe, they'll come up with some theory, and then they'll find an exception. They'll find, wait a minute. It isn't always true. Here's a case where it's not true, and all of a sudden they come up with a new theory. So as what to speak of, how do we know what's true all over the universe? Just like when the astronomers tell us how far away a star is, how do they know that? Do they go up with a tape measure and measure it? I mean, how do they know how far away that star is? How do they know? Any idea? You can go in a science museum or open a science book and they'll tell you, it'll be a rounded figure, but they'll tell you about how far away each of the stars are. How do they know that? I mean, they're not just pulling numbers out of the sky. Where are they getting those numbers from?
Do they send some kind of machine out?
Well, they can do that if they figure that the planet or the star is pretty close. But even then, how do they really know it got there? Okay, what are they getting back? What kind of information are they getting back from those stars or planets? What information are they getting? Light? And sound also sometimes. So they can guess, well, if the light's this color, then probably the star's this far away. They've made up this theory that things will be closer or further depending that the color of light is going to determine how far or how close something is. Now, even if that's true on this planet, and that's a hard thing to test on this planet because light goes in a straight line and you can only get so far away from something on this planet because this planet is curved, right? So how do they know that even if that's true on this planet, and they can't really prove that it is true on this planet, how do they know that it would be true in outer space? Maybe the reason that star is very red is not because it's further away or closer away, but maybe that's just the color that it is. Maybe it has nothing to do with distance. How do we know? We don't know. Or sound. We all know this theory of light comes to the fact that, you know, sound changes. It goes, you hear a train, it goes, woo, right? As it's going past you? You've all experienced that? It's called the Doppler effect. So again, they're assuming that that takes place also over space. Maybe it does, maybe it doesn't. How do we know? I know that that happens with something close to me, but how do I know that that's true there? And in fact, the Vedas tell us that time and space is different on different planets. That it's not exactly the same. That the most fundamental aspects of reality, time and space, don't operate the same way all over the universe. They operate differently. And that living beings are different in different parts of the universe. Some living beings have bodies made mostly of air. Our bodies are made mostly of water. Just like the planet is made mostly of water. Our bodies, our human bodies, are very similar to the constitution of the planet as a whole. We have about the same mix of earth, water, fire, air, ether as the planet. And then there are other planets where there's different combinations. So those things are different. But here Krishna is telling us of laws that are the same all over the universe. Now that's a pretty helpful thing to know. Just like you go places and there are going to be different rules. But certain rules might be the same everywhere. Wouldn't that be a nice thing to know? So Krishna starts out by telling us that this is the best knowledge he's told us so far. This is going to be something extremely useful to us. You know, I frequently make the point that good teachers tell you, this is not so important, this is medium importance, this is really important. It's very important for all of us. All of you, I assume, are acting more or less as teachers. You should always make sure that your students know what's really important and what's not really important. It doesn't mean you only teach the very important things, but you should distinguish. And you want to put most of your time and energy into the things that are really important. So Krishna is telling us this knowledge of the modes of nature is something that's very important, and that knowing this will help us become liberated. So Krishna is not just telling us this so we can know how to get along in the world. Now you notice that in the Bhagavatam, the demons often accuse Krishna of something. You know what they accuse him of? There's a certain accusation they make against him over and over and over again. Yes. They say Krishna is partial. And that's, of course, one of the main criticisms of God on this planet. That if there's a God, why is there suffering? That is the prime argument of the atheists. They really don't have any other argument but that. But they do have that argument. They say if there's a God and he's all-powerful and all-benevolent, why is there suffering? And the suffering doesn't seem to be causal in our everyday experience. It's not that everyone who dies an early or painful death is a worse person in this life than people who don't. I mean, that's just a fact, right? So it may seem like God is partial. And in fact, there are religions that teach that God is partial. You know that? There are religions that teach that there are certain people who are the elect. And that's just the way it is. Just some people are born already destined to go to heaven. And everybody else is born destined to go to hell. Now, why those people preach is beyond me. But anyway, there are people who propound such philosophies that God is partial, that he's already decided you're going to be a nice person, you're not going to be a nice person. Oh, well. You know, you're going to suffer, you're going to enjoy. Just sort of whimsical. In fact, the demigods are portrayed like that often in Greek and Roman stories. They're just sort of whimsical. Or if somebody worships them, they say, okay, I'll help you out. You know, never mind what they're like. So one of the answers given in the Bhagavatam to the fact that God is not partial has to do with the modes of nature. It said that the world is geared to favor the mode of goodness. Nature is set up so that goodness is favored. So therefore, the more you're in goodness, the more you're going to be favored. And the further you are away from goodness, the less you're going to be favored. Well, you might say, well, that's not fair either. But the definition of goodness, what's the word for goodness, the Sanskrit word? Sattva gun. What does sattva also mean? Truth. It means truth. That means the world is set up to favor truth. Well, that sounds pretty fair to me. In other words, the closer you are to doing something that's true, the happier you are. Well, that's just logical. If I want to get from here to there, the closer I follow a path that actually takes me from here to there, the faster I'll get from here to there. Right? If I do something that's factual, that's true, I'm more likely to get the result I want than if I do something that's not factual. It's a pretty simple definition of reality. And if you're totally in harmony with the truth, then where are you? You're in pure goodness. And if you're totally in harmony with the truth, you're not in material conditioning at all. Material conditioning means, material means falsity. Maya means falsity. That which is not. It means something that's not, something that's false. So the more you're in falsity, the more you suffer. Is this just logical? Okay. And the closer you are to truth, the more you're happy. And the absolute truth is a person. Truth is not just an idea. That's a pretty amazing concept. There's a person who is complete truth. That's what he is. He's truth. So the closer you get to truth, the more you're in alignment with him, the more you link with him, and the happier you are. So it really behooves us to understand this system if you want to, A, be happy in this world. Anybody here want to be miserable in the world? Sometimes people think that we're supposed to be miserable in the world. That's not our Krishna conscious philosophy. We do promote austerity, but we don't say you should try to have as miserable a life as possible. Okay, that is not our philosophy. I know that is the philosophy of some people who claim to be religious, but it's not our philosophy. Nobody wants to suffer in this world, and how you can get free of illusion. So therefore, this is very important knowledge. Now, the modes of nature, although the name of this chapter is the three modes of material nature, this chapter is mostly describing the essence. This chapter is not describing the details. The details are described in what chapter? Chapters, actually. What chapters in the Bhagavad Gita describe the details? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Somebody? Try. Better to make a mistake than not try.
17 and 18.
Excellent. 17 and 18. Very good. We learn a lot by trying. You know, you don't have to already know. It's all right. I don't already know most things. I already know very little. Okay. 17 and 18 gives us details. 17 and 18 will say, this kind of food is in goodness, this kind of food is in passion, this kind of food is in ignorance, this kind of charity, this kind of understanding. Very details. Here they're giving the big picture. So according to modern psychology, each of us personality-wise is either a big picture person or a detail person predominantly. Obviously, we can all do both, but each of us has a tendency either to look at details or to look at the big picture as our predominant way of understanding the world. And Krishna's giving both. He's giving the big picture in this chapter, and he's going to give the details later, which, by the way, is also a very good way to teach. Because the people you're teaching will, some of them have a tendency to want to see the big picture, and some of them will have a tendency to want to see details. It's a good idea to do both, and it's usually a good idea to start with the big picture. Let your big picture people be satisfied. Your detail people don't mind getting a whole view of the thing before you get into the details. But your big picture people will really be disturbed if you get into the details without knowing where you're going or what this is all about. So that's what Krishna's doing. He's giving the big picture. All right, now his big picture here is the mode of goodness will make you happy. The mode of passion makes you never happy. You always want more and more and more and more and more. It's very future-oriented. The mode of goodness is very present-oriented. You're happy. You're happy. You're satisfied. You're peaceful. You may want to improve things, but you're happy and satisfied and peaceful. You're illuminated. You're full of joy. The mode of passion, the only thing you're full of is desires. I want this, 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 I want this. I have a, 17-inch TV, I want a 19-inch. Now I want a 21-inch. Now I want a 25-inch. Now I want a 36-inch. I have 3 pairs of shoes, now I want 5 pairs of shoes. So it's a hankering. And the mode of ignorance is you're not happy and you're not hankering. At least in passion, you're doing something. In ignorance, you just don't even care. You're miserable and you don't care. You ever been like that? You're miserable and you don't care? You're doing something stupid and useless and you don't even care? So that's the mode of ignorance. Passion, you care. I'm going to try to make it better. I'm going to try to make it better. I'm trying to make it better. And goodness, you're like, it's fine. I'm satisfied. Okay. That's an essential principle. Now, it doesn't mean the person of goodness never tries to improve things. That's not a fact. It doesn't mean the person of passion is never satisfied. But that's the overriding mood. Now, another big principle, and this has to do more with the details than what's discussed in this chapter, but still I think it's important to say it now, is that the external activities of those in passion and goodness, we'll see when we get to the details, are often very, very similar. Someone who's really in the mode of passion, which we don't see that much nowadays, mostly we see people in mixed passion, ignorance or in ignorance, but people who are really in passion are very righteous, moral people. They're very religious people. They're very interested in dharma. People in the mode of goodness are very interested in moksha. People in passion are very interested in dharma. People in mixed passion ignorance are very interested in artha. And people in ignorance are very interested in karma. But someone who's in the mode of passion is very interested in being religious. Most attempts at charity and helping other people, benevolent activities, is mostly in the mode passion. I want to do good for the world. I want to do more and more and more. That's mostly in the mode of passion. The difference between the mode of passion and the mode of goodness is primarily the mentality. So someone in the mode of goodness is giving in charity, someone in the mode of passion is giving in charity, and someone in the mode of ignorance may be giving in charity also. But someone in the mode of goodness, they're giving in charity out of a desire to spread their joy. Whereas someone in the mode of passion, their interest is mostly in thinking that they're the doer and in honor and trying to think I'm a good person. I want to be a good person in society. I want others to think well of me. I want to do something lasting and significant and important in the world. That is the mode of passion. But the activities will be very similar. In ignorance, the activities are markedly different. So the way I look at it is in goodness, you do the right thing for the right reason. In passion, you do the right thing for the wrong reason. And in ignorance, you do the wrong thing for the wrong reason. And mixed passion and ignorance, sometimes you do the right thing, sometimes you do the wrong thing, but your motives are always bad. Those are very simplified ways of looking at it. Goodness means happiness, joy, light, peace, satisfaction. Passion means I'm always looking to the future and I'm always wanting more. It's a very greedy kind of mood. And ignorance is you just don't care. You're neither happy nor do you care for improvement. Right? Goodness, you do the right thing for the right reasons, passions. Generally do the right thing, but your motives are off. And ignorance, you do the wrong thing for the wrong reasons. So, all right. I'm feeling particularly enthused about this particular part of this chapter because we recently got a submission of an article for Back to Godhead that has some things in there that directly contradict one of these verses and purports. And it was making me remember how although we generally can understand what ignorance is pretty easy for us to spot, usually. we get have a lot of confusion between passion and goodness. So text one, Krishna says it's the best knowledge. And Prabhupada says if one understands this chapter through the process of philosophical speculation, he will come to an understanding of devotional service. Philosophical speculation. So I thought it'd be helpful if I read this letter from 1972. Because usually we say don't speculate, right? Mm-hmm. Don't speculate. As for the difference between mental speculation and philosophical speculation, we take it that everything is known by the psychological action of the mind. We take it that everything is known by the psychological action of the mind. So that philosophical speculation is the same as mental speculation if it is merely the random or haphazard activity of the brain to understand everything in making theories, ifs and maybes. But if philosophical speculation is directed by Shastra and Guru, and if the goal of such philosophical attempts is to achieve Vishnu, then that philosophical speculation is not mental speculation. It is just like this. Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita that I am the taste of water. Philosophical speculation, in the accepted sense, then means to try to understand, under the direction of Shastra and Guru, just how Krishna is the taste of water. The points of Bhagavad Gita, although they are simple and complete, can be understood from unlimited angles of vision. I'm going to read that again. The points of Bhagavad Gita, though they are simple and complete, can be understood from how many angles of vision? Unlimited. Now, I sometimes think this is what it says and this is all that it says. And any understanding other than what I understand is nonsense, which is an interesting concept if you think about that. The way I understand them, I'm not interpreting. My understanding is not an interpretation. And the way I understand it, that's God, as if my understanding were the same as God's. And the way you understand it is automatically Maya. So there are many, 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 many people who think this way, and I think all of us tend to think this way, at least sometimes, about something. And here Prabhupada says, unlimited angles of vision. So there's as many ways of understanding Shastra as there are people, as long as it's under Guru, Sadhu, and Shastra. So how do we balance that, that there's unlimited ways of understanding, but yet some ways may be wrong? We have to hold both those things. I mean, some ways may be absolutely wrong. If you just say, well, Krishna says surrender to me, but he doesn't really mean surrender to me. He really means surrender to the unborn Brahman. So unlimited ways of understanding under the umbrella of Guru, Sadhu, and Shastra. So please don't immediately think that someone else's way of understanding is wrong and yours is right. Or that yours is wrong and someone else is right. And there are unlimited. And understanding the Shastra in unlimited ways is something that Prabhupada really encouraged us to do. Something he wanted us to do. It's not like he said, yeah, there's really one best understanding, but if you want to try to have all different understandings, that's okay. No, he said, you should do this. In fact, that's what he said is the definition of isagosti. We get together and talk about the Shastra and try to understand it from many different angles of vision. So our philosophy is not dry like mental speculation. The proper function of the brain or psychological activity is to understand everything through Krishna's perspective or point of view. And so there is no limit to that understanding because Krishna is unlimited. And even though it can be said that the devotee who knows Krishna, he knows everything, still the philosophical process never stops, and the devotee continues to increase his knowledge even though he knows everything. Try to understand this point is a very good question. Prabhupada was very happy with this question. Many years ago, I was taking an excellent course in teaching and communication and counseling, one of the best courses I ever took. But I had to miss one of the sessions. I forget what happened. Anyway, I couldn't be there. So they were videotaping each session, and then I watched the videotape. And on this particular session, where I wasn't present, they videotaped everything, including the breaks between teaching. So during one of the breaks, the students, who were all adults and all top professionals, were sitting around discussing the nature of reality. They were definitely mental speculating. And it was so clear to me, looking at this video, what is mental speculation? Well, I don't know, is God a person or is he not a person? Well, I don't know. Sometimes I think he's just, you know, light. And yeah, but maybe he's also peace. And they were just guessing at the nature of reality. Maybe it's like this, maybe it's like that, maybe it's like this, maybe it's like that. I probably should have kept that video as a really good example of what is mental speculation. After about 10 minutes of that, I just couldn't tolerate it anymore, and I fast-forwarded to the next section of the class. But that we don't do. We don't sit around and just guess. Maybe reality is like this. No, maybe it's like this. But we do take the Shastra and try to understand it. That's very pleasing to Krishna. If you say something, aren't you pleased when somebody tries to understand what you said? And if you said something with layers of meaning, wouldn't you be pleased if someone tried to understand all the layers of meaning? That's something that's very pleasing to Krishna. But just randomly guessing is not very pleasing to him. All right. Important point. Philosophical speculation is part of our process. In fact, all the acharyas engage in philosophical speculation. You'll find it throughout Prabhupada's purports. Right now, an example doesn't come immediately to mind. Ah, yes, it does. I was just reading at the end of Krishna book how Krishna is called, what's the last word? It's Devaki, oh goodness, Devaki Janma Yadi, I think it is. Anyway, which means he's not born of Devaki. And Prabhupada said this can mean that he's unborn, that although he appears to be born of Devaki, still that's just pastime. He's not born like an ordinary human being. He said it can also mean that Yasoda is his real mother. And he gives evidence for that. He said just like Vasudeva and Devaki were talking with Yasoda and Nanda Maharaj at Kurukshetra, and they said, you're the real father and mother because you raised Krishna. He said, so the devotees say that Yasoda and Nanda are Krishna's real father and mother, and Devaki and Vasudeva are just official. So there you go. That's philosophical speculation. This is what the Shastra says. What does it mean? And there's two different meanings given from very different angles of vision. One is given from the angle of vision of tattva, what is truth, and the other from rasa. And that you can say the Vrindavan and rasa is on a more intimate level and so many things. Okay? Does that all make sense to everybody? All right, and Krishna says that when you follow this knowledge, you can come to the same level as Krishna. You can transcend it. Again, if you know how the rules work, then you can go above them, can't you? Okay. And Prabhupada takes pains in this purport to talk about the fact that we're individuals. That coming to the same nature as Krishna doesn't mean we become Krishna and doesn't mean we all are exactly alike. The fact that we're individuals, I'm not going to get into this in depth, but I just want to simply reiterate the point that individuality means individuality. It really means that. It means that on the spiritual level as souls, we all have our different favorite clothes and colors and foods, and we all have different personalities. Something like we have in this life. Something like that. Otherwise, there's no meaning to individuality and personality. It wouldn't mean anything. We look different. We think differently. We have somewhat different relationships with Krishna. We have likes and dislikes. Please don't think spiritual life means that I won't have any individual likes and dislikes anymore. Then that's no personality. So sometimes people think like that. Well, if I was really spiritual, I wouldn't like or dislike anything anymore. I wouldn't have any individual opinions. One time a devotee wrote to Prabhupada and said, the reason there's different opinions is because of impersonalism. Prabhupada said, no, the reason there's different opinions is because of personalism, because we're all individuals. He said, this idea that there's some utopia where everybody's always going to agree about everything, he said, that doesn't exist. The problem is, of course, that we see that these differences in personality in this world are a source of pain. Just like this body is a source of pain. So I might think, I don't want to have a form. The other day I banged my toe on a chair. And for the whole day I basically couldn't walk. I couldn't even walk across my room. And I was like walking on the side of my foot, holding onto the wall. And just one little toe. And I probably just touched it to the chair. I mean, it wasn't even something severe. It hurt so much. Unbelievable how much pain you can get from one little tiny part of your body that you don't generally even notice. I don't even usually remember that I have toes. So much pain that this body is capable. And I was thinking, you know, if I had banged my whole body, how much pain would I have? I'd be screaming. So because this body is such a source of pain, we may think spiritual life means not having a body. And the same way, because our individual personalities in this world are often a source of great pain. You know, I have my opinion, you have your opinion, we argue, and we feel really yucky when we argue. Right? It's not generally a happy feeling unless I'm winning. But this sort of conflict, right? This conflict between our different personalities is very unpalatable here. So we may be afraid, and we may think, how can the spiritual world be wonderful if there's different personalities? All right. Then in text 3, Prabhupada takes great pains to explain that Brahman can also refer to Mahatattva. Tattva again means? Truth. Maha means? Great, the great truth. So isn't that interesting, because the material world is often called the Mahatattva. It's also Krishna. It's also Brahman. Sarva Kalamidam Brahman. Everything is ultimately Krishna. Prabhupada says here, the total substance of the material cause in which there are three modes of nature is sometimes called Brahman. The Supreme Personality impregnates that total substance, and thus innumerable universes become possible. And then Prabhupada gives a quote from the Mundaka Upanishad to show that the material nature can also become Brahman. This is important. If we're going to say something, we need to back it up with evidence. So this is also interpretation. Krishna is using the word Brahma. Prabhupada is saying in the purport, what Krishna means by that is the material energy, and here's the evidence to show it. Also, what's important here, this verse and in text 4, is that life comes from Krishna. This is an important verse. Sarva yoni shikantaya murtaya sambhavandiya hatasam brahma mahadyonir aham bija pratapita. This is a verse that Prabhupada quotes a lot. And Prabhupada says here in the purport, all these appearances are due to the mother, material nature, and Krishna's seed-giving process. The purport is that the material world is impregnated with living entities who come out in various forms at the time of creation according to their past deeds. So this, of course, is very different from Darwin's idea. Darwin's idea is that material nature becomes alive. You know, you have a really good computer and all of a sudden it becomes alive. It says, no, don't turn me off. I don't want to use that program right now. I'd rather use another program. So that's Darwin's idea, that there was just some matter and all of a sudden that matter became aware and alive. All of a sudden, that matter had desires. So what we're saying is material nature doesn't have desires, and the living entities do, and there's a combination of matter and spirit, and Krishna's impregnating matter with living entities. And we then take our bodies according to our past desires. Okay, on to text 5. All right. Now Krishna is saying that there's three modes. And Prabhupada says, because living entities have different kinds of bodies in terms of different aspects of nature, they are induced to act according to that nature. This is the cause of the varieties of happiness and distress. And we read this in the last chapter. If you have a body of a dog, you're going to have to act like a dog. Now, sometimes we try to act like a different body. It doesn't work very well. If human beings try to act like dogs, it doesn't work very well. Frankly, even if men try to act like women or women try to act like men, it doesn't work very well. And the cause of our happiness and distress, Prabhupada says here, is the particular nature that we have. It gives us a particular kind of happiness and distress. And once you're in a particular body, you have, materially speaking, the happiness and distress of that body, and that's just it. You know, I can try to get the happiness of a tiger or the happiness of an eagle in this body, but it's not going to work very well. I'm going to have the happiness and distress of this particular body for this lifetime. It's such a simple thing. You know, just like if I'm in a particular car, while I'm in that car can do some things and it can't do certain things. And I can get the happiness of that car and the distresses of that car. If I'm in a particular house, I have the happinesses of that house and the distresses of that house. I can't, you know, that's just what it is. While I'm living in a particular country, I mean, while I'm in Auckland, I have to get the happiness and distresses of Auckland. I can't get the happiness and distresses of Hawaii when I'm in Auckland. It just doesn't happen here. I guess I could try to do it artificially. Like in America, they have this big gambling town, Las Vegas. I'm sure you've all heard of it. Have you ever been to Las Vegas? So our family once traveled all around the United States, because that's a long story. But anyway, we were told by some devotees that we should make sure we drove back through Las Vegas instead of just going on the main motorway. We should go through the town of Las Vegas because they said there's a deity of Lord Brahma there that we should go see. Because in Thailand, especially, people worship Lord Brahma. And they think he's going to bring luck. So we did indeed see this deity. He was golden color. I'm sure he wasn't real gold because he was outside under a little, like, pavilion. But driving through Las Vegas was very interesting. Las Vegas is naturally a desert. And I mean a desert. There's no water in Las Vegas, naturally. And they bring in water. Actually, as soon as you go into Nevada, where casino gambling is legal, the second you cross the state border, there's immediately a town where you can gamble, you know, 1 centimeter past the border. And they're bringing in truckloads of water because there's not naturally any water there. So all of Las Vegas is going by these truckloads of water. It's completely artificial. And they try to make it look like a heavenly planet. They're trying to give you the illusion of wealth, so that you'll spend more in gambling. And a lot of the outside of the buildings look like they were made of gold. It must be some sort of gold-colored aluminum. You know, it's very shiny and reflective. And even though there's no water there, it's very hot, they have all these fountains and waterfalls, which is very wasteful because a lot of that water is evaporating into the air. A lot of it isn't getting recycled into the fountain or waterfall. They're losing a tremendous amount of water. But they're trying to create this illusion. So sometimes we do that. Sometimes we have this body and we're not happy with this body and we try to, you know, artificially try to make it into something else. So that's exactly like people, you know, trying to make Las Vegas into some heavenly planet. It's not. It's a desert. And by doing that, of course, they're becoming so wasteful with Krishna's resources. They're putting aside all the gambling and prostitution and meat eating and alcohol consumption that goes on there. Just this concept of trying to create something that's artificial, trying to create something that's not. They're trying to get a happiness that doesn't naturally exist in that place. Of course, you see that also in the Persian Gulf. You know, like you go to these countries in the Gulf. I've been to Qatar and Abu Dhabi and Dubai and Bahrain, and there's also no water in those places. I mean, there's no water in those places. None. Nothing. It doesn't usually rain. The sun evaporates the water high enough to make us kind of mist, but it doesn't form into clouds. And all the water under the ground is salty. All the aquifers are all salty. So they desalinate ocean water. And in Dubai, they're planning on building a city that's supposed to be a model of ecology. Okay? In that climate. Hare Krishna. So that's often our attempt, right? We try to get some happiness and distress that's not due to me in this life. Try to artificially do something that's not my due. Particularly in regard to women, since we're all ladies here, that is done through modern day through contraception and abortion. You know, okay, well, I don't feel like having the happiness and distress of a woman's body. Having children is both happiness and distress. It's not all distress, and it's not all happiness either. So I don't want that. I want the happiness and distress of a male body. So therefore, I won't allow my body to get pregnant, and I'll kill a child that's conceived. So that's, of course, the modern idea in general. You know, try to somehow change the happiness and distress that goes on with my body. So I have this body according to the modes of nature. And I have that particular combination of the modes of nature. Why? Where did I get this particular combination of the modes of nature from? My desires. Why do you think it's a good idea to have to tolerate the results of our own desires? Yes, of course. So I have this particular body because of certain desires, which overall, we're not good. Otherwise, I wouldn't have a material body altogether. This material body, that material body. None of them are expressions of spiritual desires, unless I've taken a body to preach and I'm a Nityasiddha. That's a different category. You know, in training children or animals, they say that the best kind of punishment or reward is the natural consequence of the person's activity. If I break some glass, the best punishment is cleaning it up. The best punishment isn't I have someone else clean it up and I pay a fine. The more that you can deal with the natural consequences of your behavior, the more you learn. So tolerating the happiness and distress of this particular body and not trying to artificially change that is actually very good for our advancement. It's very good for our peace. And, you know, you really can't change it that much anyway. Because practically the only ways to change that is sinful, and then you end up suffering more by doing sinful things. Okay. The mode of goodness is illuminating. And Prabhupada says here in the purport that, again, he's giving a summary. One is happy, one is very active, and another is helpless. So the main qualification of goodness, the main symptom of goodness is happiness. The main symptom of passion is activity, and the main symptom of ignorance is helplessness. So all this victim stuff is very much more to ignorance. This idea of being helpless. This purport is very interesting. And I think I'm going to read the whole purport because there's so many really interesting points here. The living entities conditioned by material nature are various types. One is happy, another is very active, and another is helpless. Does that mean people in the mode of ignorance or goodness are not active? By the way? No. And devotees are very active. Prabhupada was very active. All these types of psychological manifestations are causes of the living entity's conditioned status in nature. How they are differently conditioned is explained in this section of Bhagavad Gita. The mode of goodness is first considered. The effect of developing the mode of goodness in the material world is that one becomes wiser than those otherwise conditioned. A man in the mode of goodness is not so much affected by material miseries. So two reasons. First of all, because he's just happy and satisfied in any condition. He's not so much, a person in the mode of goodness is not so much trying to adjust the material circumstances to become happy, but is finding happiness and satisfaction in whatever circumstances there are. Therefore, such a person is not so much affected by material miseries. And the other reason is that a person in goodness doesn't do so many sinful activities, and therefore just doesn't have very many miseries. And he has a sense of advancement in material knowledge. So there's a sense of knowing things, of understanding things. The representative type is the brahmana who is supposed to be situated in the mode of goodness. This sense of happiness is due to understanding that in the mode of goodness, one is more or less free from sinful reactions. Actually, in the Vedic literature, it is said that the mode of goodness means greater knowledge and a greater sense of happiness. So sinful reactions, sin means something that's opposed to truth. So if I'm in sattva, if I'm in truth, I have a sense of happiness that I'm in truth. Don't you feel happy when you're doing something that's right and true and harmonious? And you have a sense of, well, I'm doing something that's good. I mean, that's true even if you're, you know, eating organically grown food out of your own garden. You get a sense of happiness and satisfaction out of doing that because it's close to truth. You're not so much affected by sin. Sin means falsity. The more you're in falsity, the more you're going to feel in anxiety. You're not going to feel happy. So the sense of real happiness. Of course, later on, Krishna will discuss that there is a kind of happiness in the mode of passion and a kind of happiness in the mode of ignorance. On the absolute platform, happiness is only experienced in the mode of goodness. So there is something in the mode of passion and something in the mode of ignorance that people consider to be happiness. But it's not real happiness. Real happiness, whenever we experience real happiness, we're in some touch of goodness. The difficulty here is that when a living entity is situated in the mode of goodness, he becomes conditioned to feel that he is advanced in knowledge and is better than others. That is called Pride. Now, pride is when. What mode do you think?
Passion.
So here it's saying that when you become in goodness, you're likely to feel proud, which is why material goodness is not pure goodness. There's some influence of the mode of passion or even ignorance. In Sudha-sattva, there's no pride. In pure goodness, there's no pride. In fact, in pure goodness, there's great humility. Because what is the ultimate truth? We're saying goodness is the same as truth. When I really get close to the truth, what do I see? What's the truth? Who am I? Nothing. I'm nothing. How big is this whole city of Auckland on a map? It's a pinprick. How big is the whole earth in the universe? It's barely a spot of light. So who am I? Nothing, basically. I'm very significant that because Krishna loves me. And in one sense, you know, as a soul, I'm superior to all of matter. But really, I'm not very important. I'm very important, but I'm not very important. Does that make any sense? I'm very important to Krishna. Sanat Singh Goswami says that everyone in the spiritual world thinks they're Krishna's favorites, and each of them are. So I'm Krishna's favorite. Isn't that nice? And I'm very important, and everything I do that pleases Krishna is very meaningful. At the same time, I have absolutely no meaning or significance whatsoever. And the example that I always give of this is, how many of us know the names of our great-great-grandfathers and grandmothers? Great-great. Most of us know the names of our grandparents. Probably we've met our grandparents, although I only was only able to meet one grandparent of mine. The others had died before I was born. And I personally met one of my great-grandparents. I can remember most of the names of my great-grandparents, but great-great? I don't know any of their names. Occasionally I meet someone who tell me they know the name of one great-great-grandparent. What to speak of, what did they do? What did they do in their life? Do you know? So that means that my great-great-grandchildren will not even know my name. And that's my own family. So how important am I? Not very important. Even now, my intimate family members do not even know always what I'm doing. And they don't even always care. I forget where I was, somewhere. And my daughter wrote me this email, something like, "Oh, I didn't know you were in such and such place. What are you doing there?" And I communicate with her probably at least 3 times a week. I mean, how interested are all of you guys in what your mother is doing today? Does that really interest you? Do you even know what it is? So how important are we? We're not very important. So when you really come to truth, you come to humility. Humility is a nice thing, by the way. Truth is always nice. So honesty is always nice. Honesty, truth, those are the same thing, right? It's always refreshing. So it's a lot more refreshing if I can just be, hey, you know, I'm not very important. I don't have to try to be somebody important anymore. What a relief. Useless endeavor anyway. But in the material world, this mode of goodness tends to bring this idea that I'm much more important. And we see this in religions all the time. Somebody becomes a little religious, a little pious, and they think, I'm better than everybody else. In this way, he becomes conditioned. The best examples are the scientist and the philosopher. Each is very proud of his knowledge, and because they generally improve their living conditions, they feel a sort of material happiness. So also such people tend to live, scientists, philosophers, they tend to live pretty nice material lives, don't they? They get respect from people, they usually tend to have enough money, and those sort of people are not interested in a lot of money, are they? Generally speaking. It's not their interest. This sense of advanced happiness in conditioned life makes them bound by the mode of goodness as material nature. As such, they are attracted towards working in the mode of goodness. And as long as they have an attraction for working in that way, they have to take some kind of body in the modes of nature. Thus, there is no likelihood of liberation or being transferred to the spiritual world. Repeatedly, one may become a philosopher, a scientist, or a poet. Repeatedly, one may become a philosopher, a scientist, or a poet, and repeatedly become entangled in the same disadvantages of birth and death. But due to the illusion of the material energy, one thinks that that sort of life is pleasant. You can take repeated births in the mode of goodness, my dear friends. You don't have to become degraded. Sometimes devotees ask the question, why has Krishna rigged the material world so you can't be happy here? He has not rigged the material world so you can't be happy here. You can take repeated births in the mode of goodness and be happy. Now, you're not going to have ultimate transcendental happiness. But that's not a rigging of the material world. That's our choice. You can have ultimate transcendental happiness in the material world also. But then you're not in material consciousness. If the question is, why can't I both be in material consciousness and have ultimate transcendental happiness, that question doesn't really make any sense. That's like saying, why can't I be false and yet be full of truth? It's really a nonsensical question. But can I be in a consciousness of some degree of falsity and yet have happiness forever? Sure, you can take birth over and over and over again in the mode of goodness. Do people usually do that? No. But can you? Sure. Krishna has not prejudiced things. You're not forced to become an animal. You're not forced to become, you know, some spider. That's not forced. Yes? It's very hard to maintain mode of goodness, yes. Because you see, the mode of goodness is contaminated by the mode of passion in this world. There's some contamination of the mode of passion. Yeah, and there's, as we'll come to in the next few verses, the different modes change at different times of the day and different times of the year. It's very, very difficult. You know, if you're wandering around a bookstore, you can just stay in the philosophy section. But there's every chance of becoming attracted by, you know, the romance section or the horror book section. It's risky. It's definitely risky. It's not some kind of sure thing. Once you're in transcendental consciousness, falling to material consciousness is very, very difficult. It's possible, but it's very difficult. You have to make a strong, concerted effort to do it. You have to work really, really hard to be in Maya once you're in transcendental consciousness. But to go from the mode of goodness to the mode of passion or ignorance is not that difficult. But anyway, you can do it. It's not that you can't do it. It's not that Krishna hasn't set things up so you can't do it. You can. You can take birth over and over and over again on the higher planets. And if that's what you want. I'm sure there are some living entities that do that. Okay, passion is born of unlimited desires and longings. So again, the person in goodness is just happy and satisfied. The person in passion, they're never satisfied. Everything's always got to be better. They're not happy now. It's something like the donkey with the carrot. Their happiness is always future. If they get something nice, maybe they enjoy it for 5 minutes and then immediately they want something more. Does that make sense? I had it more, different, more, more, different. Now, Prabhupada does talk about always wanting to expand the Krishna consciousness movement. And I'm thinking about Hanuman. Hanuman goes to Lanka, and his order from Ramachandra was just to find where Sita was. And actually, he didn't even have to jump to Lanka to do that because the vulture Sampati could see Sita from across the ocean. He said, I see her. She's in the garden there and that island. That's why Hanuman jumped there. So he really didn't have to jump there at all. He could have gone back to Ram and said, you know, Sampati saw her. Now, maybe he wanted to go there personally to just make sure. Maybe he didn't fully trust Sampati, but he really decided to go to Lanka to do something more, and that was to give Sita some assurance. He wanted to go and tell her, it's okay, Ram is coming. And Ram had given him a ring to give to Sita. He wanted to say, don't worry. So that was something actually beyond the base thing that he needed to do. And then when he was there in Lanka, he decided also that he was going to do something beyond that. He decided he was going to act as a spy and check out the city. And he had a strategy to do this. he decided he was going to have Ravana capture him, and in that way he'd get a chance to see the whole city and check it out and be able to give Ram some more involved information. So he caused a big disturbance. He went to this grove of fruit trees and he knocked down the trees and really caused a whole scene. And he even killed, what was his name? Killed one of Ravana's sons, I think, Akshayananda. Akshay something. And he killed the son of Ravana. Then he had to be captured by Indrajit and he was taken to Ravana's court. Then he also told Ravana, hey, look, you know, Ram is coming and he's going to kill you and this is a whole bad policy and you should return Sita. So that also was beyond what he was given to do. And then, of course, he couldn't have anticipated what happened next, but Ravana decided he should be killed. And Ravana's brother, Vibhishan, who's a devotee, said, no, you can't kill messengers. That's against the Shastra. You can punish them. You can even maim them, but you can't kill them. Because after all, they're only delivering the message of their master. You can kill the master. He said, all right, we'll maim him. We'll take off his tail, because monkeys are very proud of their tail. But we won't just cut off his tail. We'll do it through torture. We'll burn his tail off. So they set Hanuman's tail on fire, and he thought, oh, good opportunity. Now I can do something even more. And he jumps around the city and lights all the buildings on fire before he puts out the fire on his tail. And, of course, he didn't lose his tail. So he definitely wanted something more, is my point. Of course, that's risky because going beyond an instruction can sometimes be as dangerous as going below an instruction. But the point is that he wanted to do something more. He thought, how can I serve Ram more? Or Srila Prabhupada was told by Bhaktisiddhanta, preach in English to English-speaking people. Prabhupada was not, as far as I know, specifically told by Bhaktisiddhanta to go to the West. Now, he knew Bhaktisiddhanta wanted to spread Krishna consciousness in the West because Bhaktisiddhanta had sent Bhan Maharaj to London. So Prabhupada knew that. He knew that was his guru's desire. But he hadn't been given that specific instruction. And at first he tried to preach in English to English-speaking people in India. And then he thought, well, you know, London didn't work. My godbrother went to London and failed. And really, America is more leading the world than Britain right now. Why don't I go to America instead of London? Now, why don't I go to New York? So that was taking it certainly a step further. Right? And just preach in English. I mean, did Bhaktisiddhanta tell him to establish foreign communities and schools and, you know, gorgeous temples and Vrindavan? No, those were not specific instructions. Anyway, my point is that the devotee certainly wants to do more. But the devotee is also happy now. The devotee is not wanting to do more because of a sense of dissatisfaction. For the devotee's personal self, they're totally satisfied with whatever they have. That's just a mode of goodness, folks. That's not even devotee. A person in the mode of goodness are satisfied with what they have. They have a small house, they have a big house. They have nice clothes, they don't have nice clothes. They have nice food, they don't have nice food. Whatever. They're satisfied. They're not trying to increase their happiness by changing or increasing their circumstances. But for Krishna's service, we want to change and increase our circumstances. For Krishna's service, we'll look to get a bigger building or a better building. For Krishna's service, we want to try to increase the preaching. But for ourselves personally, for our own sense gratification, we're satisfied easily. Does that make sense? Now, you also see sometimes people in the mode of ignorance. They'll work very hard. I'm sure some drug dealers work really hard. So sometimes there may be, that's then mixed passion ignorance. You don't find too much pure ignorance. Pure ignorance is just like this cup. That's pure ignorance. And pure goodness is spirit. Okay, Prabhupada says here that the main feature of the mode of passion is sexual attraction. And that as soon as there's sexual attraction, you want to increase immediately. And the symbol of sexual attraction, my dear friends, is a woman. Now, they're trying to kind of artificially change that in modern society, but it doesn't work very well. If you really want to sell soap, you don't put an attractive man, you put an attractive woman. I mean, even if you're trying to sell soap to women. Have you ever noticed that women's magazines are also full of pictures of attractive women? Mm-hmm. Ever think about that? So some women object to the statements in Shastra that the womanly form is the symbol of material life. But, you know, everybody knows that. Sorry about that. Everyone knows that. If you want to say, become successful in life, become romantically attractive, and have wealth, and what do you use? A beautiful woman, usually who's not dressed very thoroughly, or in some sort of seductive pose. And women are called Sri, she who expands. So as soon as somebody gets in touch with a woman, they generally want to expand. Let me get a bigger house, let me get a big car, let me do this, let me do that. And Prabhupada talks about wanting some honor in society, in the nation, having a happy family with nice children. That's all the mode of passion. And we who are in female bodies, our tendency is to expand. Our tendency is going to be in the mode of passion. Even if you're a Brahminical woman, there's going to be a stronger influence of passion than in a Brahminical man. A Brahminical woman is more in goodness than a Kshatriya woman or a Vaishya woman or a Shudra woman, but there's still more passion there in a woman's body. That's the tendency. Tendency is to expand. Why do men want honor in society? Mostly to impress women. Also, please be careful how you use this. I've talked about this before. Be careful how you use it. It's part of our nature. It's not going to go away. Be careful what you do with it. It's a very strong tendency. And sometimes we push a man in this regard, calling it spiritual life. You need to do more of this. You need to do this better. You need to do more of this. You need to do this better. Never being satisfied. Now, to some extent, that's good for a man. Gets a man out of ignorance to be with a woman. But please be very careful. And Prabhupada says here, modern civilization is considered to be advanced in the standard of the mode of passion. Formerly, the advanced condition was considered to be the mode of goodness. If there's no liberation in the mode of goodness, what to speak of those who are entangled in the mode of passion? So in modern society, most religious organizations are pushing the mode of passion, not goodness. In America, at least, they talk about family values. What are they talking about? They're talking about the mode of passion. They think righteousness means, okay, you know, I have a nice family, happy, intelligent kids, a nice house, good car, lots of money in the bank, and I'm charitable. Please remember that generally the desire for philanthropy is a mode of passion, not goodness. I want to help everybody. I want to be a friend to everybody. I want to do good to the world. I want to be a righteous person. I want to be honored in society. I want to be successful in the world. That's the mode of passion. And the in a good way. I mean, I want to be successful in the world. Mode of passion is I want to be successful in the world in a righteous, honest, upright way. Not through cheating. That's mode of ignorance. I want to be a good citizen. I want to be a good religious person. And most, even religious people, are pushing that as the ideal. Right? Isn't it? All right, mode of darkness, born of ignorance, is delusion. And Prabhupada said the word to, or which means but, is very significant. Again, we see the good teacher tells us what's important and what's not. Prabhupada says this little word, too, which just means but, is very important in this verse. Why? Because the mode of ignorance is just opposite. Again, total mode of ignorance is matter. Yeah? Okay. So total mode of goodness is spirit, total mode of ignorance is matter. And the closer you get, the closer a living being gets to the mode of ignorance, the more peculiar it is. Prabhupada uses that word. He says the mode of ignorance is a very peculiar qualification of the embodied soul. It's madness. Prabhupada says one cannot understand a thing as it is. And he gives the example that, you know, our grandparents have died. He said the children you conceive will also die, but still you run around trying to be happy in this world. See, that's not the mode of passion. Mode of passion people are aiming for? Heaven. Mode of ignorance is, oh, I don't care. I'm just going to go out and be happy in the world. Everybody's going to die. Oh, no matter. That's the mode of ignorance. You can't even see the plain fact that you and everyone else is going to die. Okay. Text 9. Again, this is the summary. Happiness, fruit of action, and madness. This purport is very important. 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 A person in the mode of goodness is satisfied by his work or intellectual pursuit, just as a philosopher, scientist, or educator may be engaged in a particular field of knowledge and may be satisfied in that way. So I was just reading this thing from a devotee. She said she had interviewed some scientists and asked them, why do you do your science work? And many of them said, because it brings us satisfaction. And she said, ah, mode of passion. I said, no, that's the mode of goodness. Mode of goodness is just, I'm satisfied with my work, whatever my work may be. I have a sense of satisfaction. And Prabhupada gives the example of the scientist, the philosopher. Their satisfaction is not in getting honor. I mean, it could be, but he's giving an example of someone whose satisfaction is not coming from being honored. It's not coming from making a lot of money. It's not even coming from thinking, I'm doing something great for human society. Just satisfied with the work. Especially if that work is science or philosophy or education, because science, philosophy, and education is supposed to at least deal with truth. Science, philosophy, and education are supposed to deal with truth. Philo also means love, by the way. Science means to know. So if someone's doing something that has to do with truth and love, and they're satisfied with that, they're doing it just for that, because they love truth. They don't need anything else. They're happy with that. So is that material? Yes. Is it sense gratification? Yes. This devotee said, because it's mental sense gratification, it's in the mode of passion. Of course it's mental sense gratification. Is it in the mode of passion? No. It's in the mode of goodness. And the reason I say this is important is that I find so many times devotees think that it's very spiritual not to be happy with your work. I can't count how many times I've heard this. It's more surrendered. It's more spiritual if you're not happy with your work. Nonsense. Who's not happy with their work? The person in passion is never happy with their work. They're always feeling dissatisfied. Could speak of the person in mode of ignorance. They don't even care about being happy in their work. It's in the mode of goodness to feel satisfied with your work, especially if your work isn't truth. I mean, if your work is, you know, killing animals and you're happy with it, that's maybe a problem. But if you're working in the realm of truth and you're happy with it, that's in goodness. And even in Krishna consciousness, up through the stage of ruchi, one is getting some satisfaction from one's service. After ruchi, one gets satisfaction just from pleasing Krishna, not from the service itself. And that, my friends, is a very, very, very high level of advancement. Nista, it means you're liberated. At ruchi, you're basically a liberated soul. Your contamination is very slight. And at ruchi, you're getting happiness from the service. You have a taste from the service. At a shakti, your taste comes from Krishna. It doesn't matter what service you do. We should be happy and satisfied in our service. If we're not, we're functioning at one of the lower modes. And it means that we're not rightly situated. Please, give yourself permission to be happy and satisfied in your service. Please. Please, 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 please. Really. If you're enjoying your service for Krishna, that's very nice. Even if it's mental sense gratification. Well, at least you're in the mode of goodness. Please, be happy with that. And if you're supervising other people, help them to be in a situation where they can be also happy and satisfied in their service. If we're doing service for the sake of service, and if we're doing our service for the sake of honor and prestige and money and facility, that's in the mode of passion. Then we're not being happy and satisfied with our service. Then we're happy and satisfied, but we're never really happy and satisfied because we'll never get enough honor or enough money or enough whatever. Suffering more than others. That's mode of passion. But just be happy, to be happy with the work itself. That means, of course, one has to be engaged according to one's propensity, which is a very important principle of Bhagavad Gita. It's very difficult to be happy with the work itself if you're not engaged according to your propensity. one of the hallmarks of being engaged according to your propensity is that you're happy with the work itself. Now, even out in the material world, they know that one of the most important features of happiness with job satisfaction is that you like the work that you're doing, that you find it to be satisfying. So yeah, someone in the mode of goodness, they're happy because they're engaged with truth. That's enough for them. And Prabhupada says here, a man in the mode of passion may be engaged in fruitive activity. He owns as much as he can and he spends for good causes. Again, this tendency, I want to help everybody in the world. The ultimate expression of the mode of passion, as we'll see later in the Bhagavad Gita, is the king. Now, the Brahmana wants to teach truth to the world, but the Brahmana isn't thinking, I'm going to help everybody in the world, I'm such a great person. That's the mentality of the king. Sometimes he tries to open hospitals, give to charity institutions, etc. These are signs of one in the mode of passion. We usually think that's in the mode of goodness. Isn't that funny? So we think that if you're happy in your work, that's in the mode of passion because it's mental sense gratification. And we think if you're doing charity in hospitals, that's in the mode of goodness. No, that's in the mode of passion. The person in the mode of goodness is very satisfied. Remember, the mode of passion is interested in righteousness. Someone in the mode of passion is not interested in sinful activity. They're interested in pious activity, but the motive is off. The motive is off and the internal feeling is off. The interest in pious activity out of greed. And the mode of ignorance covers knowledge. And the mode of ignorance, whatever one does is good neither for him nor for anyone. So the mode of passion, you're trying to benefit others also. Okay. Sometimes the mode of goodness becomes prominent, sometimes the mode of passion, sometimes the mode of ignorance. Now this happens at certain times of the day, certain times of the year, at certain places in the world. Certain places are more in the mode of ignorance. Certain climates. We talk about the forest is in goodness, the city is in passion, the brothel, liquor store are in ignorance, but also different areas of the world. A place in the world where you can, you know, maintain yourself without much work, a very tropical climate where there's just fruit and vegetables growing naturally is much more in the mode of goodness. You know, a place where there's no natural water is definitely in the mode of ignorance. And then, again, at certain times of the day. And when ignorance becomes dominant, those in the modes of passion and goodness can't function very well. And same with the mode of goodness. Why are most people in the world waking up after we do? Why can't most people in the world wake up at 3 or 4 in the morning? That's when the mode of goodness is active. And they're not getting any energy from that. They can't work. Can't do anything. Doesn't do anything for them. They just go to sleep. Whereas the mode of ignorance, of course, becomes dominant starting about twilight. And about the only thing we want to do then is sleep. It's very hard for us to be active then. Does that make sense? So at different times of day, different modes are active. And what we do is we try to adjust our activity. When the mode of goodness is active, we spend our time in study and meditation. When the mode of passion is active, we spend our time in active service and in preaching. When the mode of ignorance is active, we go to sleep. So also we try to work with the modes without being influenced by them. But this is also why it's so hard to maintain any position in this world, because these things are always changing. Why do you think Krishna has it so that these things are always changing? Why are different times of the day, different times of the year, different places under the influence of the different modes? Why didn't he just set it up so it's always a mode of goodness that's active? Thank you. Yes. Because Krishna's very kind. If you wanted to be in the mode of passion and it was always the mode of goodness, you really couldn't function very well. It's Krishna's kindness that he's made night. People in the mode of ignorance become very energized at night, don't they? If you want to have illicit sex, intoxication, meat eating, gambling, violence, you get energy at night, don't you? Right? That's Krishna's kindness. That's also why there's different yugas. Satya Yuga, Treta Yuga, Dwapara Yuga, and Kali Yuga. It's a facility for everybody to become a human being. It's That's Krishna's kindness. Now, Prabhupada says in this purport, very important. The prominence of some different mode of nature is manifest in one's dealings, in his activities, in eating, etc. All this will be explained in later chapters. So again, the details are explained in later chapters. You cannot decide what mode you or anybody else is in just by looking at even the general characteristics. All right? You've got to look at the details. Because although Prabhupada's mentioned here charities in the mode of passion, there's charity in the mode of goodness, and there's charity in the mode of ignorance. It's not that everyone who gives charity is in the mode of passion. And it's not that all people who are happy and satisfied are in the mode of goodness. You have to look at the whole at the picture holistically. And here, Krishna is giving general, Prabhupada says in this purport, details are given later. And most people are mixed. Again, pure goodness is spiritual, pure ignorance is matter. Most of us are mixed, but we have some dominant mode. So you have to look at everything totally. And then he says that if you want, you can develop by practice mode of goodness and thus defeat mode of ignorance and passion. One can similarly develop the mode of passion and defeat goodness and ignorance. Or one can develop the mode of ignorance and defeat goodness and passion. This is a very important point. We often say that we have free will only to choose Krishna or Maya. However, we also have free will how we're going to choose Krishna, and we have free will how we're going to choose Maya. It's not that if you choose Maya, then automatically you're going to, you know, you just no longer have any control over what you're doing. Because if that were true, there'd be no meaning to the law of karma. How could you be held responsible for your activities if you're just being forced by material nature? So Prabhupada says here, you can choose what mode of nature you're under by practice. You can change your mode of nature by practice. Then he also says here that if you're determined, you can be blessed by the mode of goodness, and by transcending the mode of goodness, you can be situated in pure goodness, which is called the Vasudeva state, a state in which one can understand the science of God. So goodness is a stepping ground. I remember Jayapataka Maharaj talking about goodness as an airport. It's like, pretty soon I'm going to go to America. So I don't go to America by going to the airport, but I do go to America by going to the airport. You understand? Just going to the airport doesn't take me to America. I'm still in the airport. But without going to the airport, I can't get on the plane to go to America. So the mode of goodness isn't enough. The mode of goodness is still material. The mode of goodness will not bring you alone to transcendence. Although many people who are in the mode of goodness, especially if they're really in the mode of goodness, think that they're very spiritual. They're not, but they're in the airport. Good start. So generally, although we're not attached to any of the modes, Prabhupada says the devotee lives their life in the mode of goodness. Why? It's a stepping stone to pure goodness. But only in pure goodness can we really understand God. Then just again, he said, by the manifestation of particular activities, it can be understood in which mode of nature he's situated. So we look at a person's activities as a whole. All right, now Krishna's giving again three summaries. That in goodness, all the gates of the body are illumined by knowledge. Prabhupada says here, we see, taste, smell things in the right perspective. I see things as they are. I see them in truth. I smell things in truth. I was just reading these wonderful lectures in which Burjan Prabhu's wife, Jagatarini, I don't know if you know, guys know Burjan and Jagatarini. If you don't know them, get to know them. Their headquarters are in Perth, Australia, and in Vrindavan. And Jagatarini was recommending to me that I listen to Prabhupada's two lectures on Bhagavad Gita, Chapter 7, Text 8. I didn't get a chance to listen to them, but I read them. And Prabhupada was talking about seeing Krishna in the taste of water and the light of the sun. He was saying how everything we smell is Krishna, everything we taste is Krishna. Such a wonderful, wonderful lecture. And basically, having the gates of your body illumined by knowledge means that you see that everything is ultimately Krishna. And Prabhupada was saying how the Hare Krishna mantra is transcendental sound. He said, but every sound is ultimately Krishna. This brings us to a little bit of a tangent discussion. Prabhupada was saying in these classes that any liquid, the taste of any liquid, he said even Coca-Cola, even wine, the taste of that is also Krishna. All right, so let's say you're talking to somebody who drinks alcohol. So you'd say to them, it's really not good to drink alcohol. You should give it up. And suppose they say to you, I really don't want to give it up. What can you say to them?
Think that the taste is Krishna.
Think that the taste is Krishna. For many reasons, devotees are hesitant to preach like this. I don't find devotees preaching like this very often. All they say to people is give it up. Now, let's look at ourselves for a minute. I'm going to assume that no one here is on the stage of Prema Bhakti, and if you are, I apologize, and you can take this as a preaching strategy. But if we're not on the stage of Prema Bhakti, that means that I have something that I'm doing or thinking or feeling that's not in relationship to Krishna. Does that make sense? That makes sense? Okay. What we tend to do, and Jagatarini wrote this very nicely in this letter to me, we tend to think, okay, this part of my life is Krishna, and this part of my life is Maya. And the Maya part of my life, of course, when you first join the movement, you don't think you have any part of your life Maya. So if you're in that category, then you just ignore what I'm saying. All your life is Krishna. But as you advance, you start seeing that part of my life is Krishna and part of my life is Maya. And what we tend to do with the Maya part is be very ashamed of it. We try to pretend it's not there, or we feel guilty about it, or something like that. We try to hide it from Krishna. We certainly try to hide it from the other devotees, but we also try to hide it from Krishna. Let Krishna not know that I have this part of me that's Maya. I'm going to say something very radical. You know what's a lot better than doing that? See how it's connected with Krishna. Because what is Maya? Maya means to see how something is separated from Krishna. See how whatever pleasure you're getting from that, if you weren't getting any pleasure from doing or thinking or whatever that thing is, if you weren't getting any pleasure from it, you wouldn't do it, would you? And what is that pleasure ultimately you're getting? It's Krishna. Now, something very interesting will happen when you do that. And I won't say what it is, but give it a try. It's quite interesting. What happens when we're ashamed and guilty about something and we're trying to hide it is, paradoxically, you'll end up doing it more, and the addiction to it will become strengthened. And there's a whole psychology as to why that happens, but it's quite interesting. And this, you know, guilt and shame is useful, but if you're absorbed in guilt and shame, what mode is that? Mm-hmm. Ignorance. And if you start seeing the connection with Krishna, guess what mode you're going to come to? Goodness. And if you start coming to the mode of goodness, guess what's going to happen to your Maya? It will go away. So, of course, doing this is very counterintuitive. No, I don't want to connect that with Krishna. I don't want to see how Krishna's there. If I see Krishna there, I'll do it more. No, it'll be exactly the opposite. Just like we read earlier in the 12th chapter, where Krishna says that if you don't want to work for me, you could give him charity. And Prabhupada says if a person's giving in charity, after a while they'll think, I wonder what the best cause to give to is. If I start to realize that whatever my... Let's say, and I'm sure that's not true for any of us here, but let's say that someone's Maya is watching television. If one starts thinking, now, what pleasure am I getting from this? Instead of just thinking, oh, this is all nonsense, this is all terrible, this is all... What pleasure am I getting from this? And to see how that's Krishna, what's the next step what person's going to think? Could be getting so much pleasure if I went right to Krishna. That's how it works. Oh, the pleasure from this Coca-Cola, that pleasure is actually Krishna. That taste is Krishna. That experience is actually Krishna. Well, why don't I just go to Krishna? It's quite interesting. And I was just thinking about this because when I brought up this point in Italy, people were shocked. I said, see Krishna as in your activities. I said, even if your activities are nonsense, see Krishna in the activities. I said, better you give up those nonsense activities, but if you're attached to them, see how they're connected with Krishna. People are like, oh, I thought we're not allowed to do that. I thought, well, that's a pretty funny thing. I mean, think of it in terms of your preaching. Would you say to someone who's drinking alcohol, now make sure you don't think about Krishna while you're drinking alcohol? You can see how absurd it is. Right? Does that make sense? If someone says, well, you know, I have my boyfriend and I don't want to give up my relationship with my boyfriend, I know it's illicit. Well, make sure that, you know, when you're with your boyfriend, you don't think about Krishna. Whatever you do, don't think about Krishna when you're with him. I mean, would we say that? No. We might say, you know, you can think of, if I'm having so much fun with my boyfriend, where's that pleasure coming from? That pleasure is actually coming from Krishna. How much more fun would you have if you were with Krishna? Somebody was writing to me about how to preach to people who are engaged in a particular kind of sinful activity. And I said, you should tell them that the pleasure they're getting from that sin is actually Krishna. They said, no, we're not supposed to do that. So what are you going to do? Okay, during this part of the day, make sure you forget about Krishna. Don't think of Krishna during that part of the day. While you're watching your television, while you're drinking your alcohol. I think it's just like if someone says, okay, well, I've stopped eating cows, but I'm still eating chicken. Are you going to say, no, don't thank God for the chicken? Of course we wouldn't say that. We could say, well, what kind of pleasure you're getting from eating the chicken? What is it? What's that pleasure? It's Dasa to Krishna. Think about how it's Krishna. And after a while, if you're thinking about Krishna while you're eating the chicken, after a while you start thinking, you know, I don't think this is very pleasing to Krishna. I don't think I want to do this anymore. So that's all the gates of the body are illumined by knowledge. One is always seeing things in the right perspective, and seeing things in the right perspective means that I'm seeing how everything's in relationship to Krishna. If I see how everything's in relationship to Krishna, then sooner or later, everything is going to be done in a way that's pleasing Krishna. Don't make a part of your life separate from Krishna. That is the essential principle. Always think about Krishna. Always see things in relationship to Krishna. That is the mode of goodness. Okay, mode of passion, great attachment, fruit of activity, intense endeavor, uncontrollable desire and hankering. By the way, uncontrollable desire and hankering to please Krishna is wonderful. That is the price for Raganuga Bhakti. This is uncontrollable desire to please myself as misidentified by the body. I want more clothes, I want better clothes, I want a bigger house, I want a better climate, I want more of this, I want more of that. It often masquerades as Krishna consciousness. Be careful. I would say there's no end to sense gratification. There's never end to it. If you're in a space where you feel there's no end, now I got the perfect pair of shoes. Now I need the perfect hat. You know, whatever it is, there's just no end to it. I've got the perfect computer. Now I need the perfect iPod. Now I need the perfect this. Now I need the perfect that. Now I need the perfect this. Now I got to have this perfect. And again, we can do this in the name of Krishna consciousness. Let's see, I've got to be in the perfect place for my Krishna consciousness. I've got to be with the perfect people, and I've got to this and that and this. And then you're spending all your time getting all of this and that, and you're spending none of your time being Krishna conscious. Right? Does that happen? That's the mode of passion. But an intense, uncontrollable desire and hankering for Krishna is very nice. If we're thinking, how can I make Krishna happy? How can I make Krishna happier? What can I do to make Krishna even happier? I wonder how I can make Krishna happier. How can I improve my service to Krishna? That's very nice. That's wonderful. Someone in the mode of goodness, they're not going to make some big endeavor because they're already satisfied. If I'm already satisfied, why should I make a big endeavor? Right? Make sense? They're not going to want a bigger house than this. They're already happy. So for ourselves, we're already happy. But for Krishna, we'll do anything. The person in the mode of passion, they'll do almost anything, you know, they'll do anything. They'll put in 70-hour weeks. More, better. So we can think, for ourselves, we're satisfied. For Krishna, we can do more, better. Forever, eternally. And mode of ignorance, darkness, inertia, madness, and illusion. He does not work by regulative principle. He just acts whimsily. Just whatever I feel like doing, I'll do. See, the mode of work, person in the mode of passion, they're following the rules. They're following the scripture. In the mode of ignorance, they just do whatever they want. And a person has capacity to work, but he doesn't make any endeavor. I'll just live on the dole. A person in ignorance may also have a kind of satisfaction, but he's not happy. person of ignorance may also not care about improving their life, but it's not because they're happy and satisfied. It's just because they're lazy. Do you understand the difference? They're just lazy, or they're intoxicated, or they just don't care about anything. They don't even care about themselves. Okay? Although consciousness is going on, life is inactive. So again, we rarely see people who are fully ignorant. Usually people are mixed ignorance and passion. We rarely see anybody on the planet today who's in full passion also. That's unusual. What to speak of goodness. All right, I didn't even look at my notes. Huh. Except for that one thing on philosophical speculation. I should probably look at these. Not seeing if there's anything in particular I wanted to bring up. On text 11 about the manifestations of the gates illumined by knowledge, we could contrast this with spiritual, total spiritual life, pure goodness, where each of the senses is described as being separately enlivened. So it feels like one's whole body is a nose to smell Krishna, one's whole body is an eye to smell Krishna, one's whole body is an ear to hear Krishna. There are some very nice descriptions of prema like that. Okay. So, of course, as always, it's later than I always aim to end at 8:30, and it never happens. So if we want to go around, just give up and just surrender to the fact that it's not going to happen. I guess you've all come to that decision by now, right? All right. I think it's too hard to go over that many verses. So why don't we go around, and the parts that you really liked were some questions. We can start with you, Tulsi Krishna. Madhurya Kadambini by Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur. It's also in Bhagavatam, first canto, in relation to Narada Muni seeing the Lord. And I'm sure it's in other places in Bhagavatam, but that's one place that comes to mind. But it's in the last nectar shower of Madhurya Kadambini. It's in the Bhagavatam, I believe it's in the first canto, when Narada is explaining to his disciple Vyasadeva how he was the son of a maidservant, how he traveled and meditated, and in meditation contacted Lord Vishnu. But the most detailed explanation I know of is in the last part of Madhurya Kadambini. Anything else you wanted to bring up?
No, I was just thinking that originally you mentioned how Krishna was talking aspects of and I was appreciating having the maturity to understand that, because there's so many different contradictions sometimes that come out.
Yes.
And I was sort of thinking that one can become really discouraged when they sort of think that for instance, the subject of chanting, someone might be trained to really just hear the mantra and just hear, and then I might be finding that they just can't really do that. So, wow, I'm out of the attack or something. And so, I remember reading the book, The Art of Chanting, and how what they got from reading them. It's like, so I just think that sometimes in the chanting, it's like you see if some ignorant person is going to be drinking alcohol and encourage them to at least think of Krishna. So if we're chanting Mahamantra, some thought comes in, it might be a bit mundane, it might be some desire or some distraction. But if we can, in a more positive way, look at that and dovetail it somehow because I know in the book The Art of Chanting, I do encourage that.
Well, actually, at the stage of Ashakti, whatever mundane thoughts or things go around, you automatically connect that with Krishna. So that's not a bad thing to practice. If something mundane comes along and it immediately brings you to Krishna, then that's very nice. That's much better than just trying to stop it.
It takes quite a bit of maturity still, even though, isn't it? Because you can record.
Well, you're not going to fully do that until you're at the stage of Vishakti. But you can practice.
Well, I just found it really encouraging.
Oh, good. Well, I'm glad you found it encouraging. Thank you. Lila May, did you have something you wanted to share? Or? Okay.
But, the one thing is that we get the result of the mode of goodness is knowledge.
The result of the mode of goodness is knowledge, yes.
So, but you need knowledge to come to the mode of goodness.
Well, it's always like that. You need knowledge to come to the mode of goodness, but the result is knowledge. It's always like that. How would they get the desire to change? Where does the desire come from? I don't know if there's one answer to that. I mean, obviously Krishna in the heart is, you know, always asking the soul to be elevated. That's sort of a constant thing. Krishna is always putting out this, you know, come on, come on, come on, come on, come on. And desire may come by association. You may see somebody else who's elevated and think, you know, what am I doing? Let me do better than that. Or it may just come because you're suffering so much and you say, you know, I really think I'm tired of suffering. Maybe there's a better life. And I think there's probably a large number of ways in which you might decide to change. And it might, in which you might decide to go down too. You know, you can go up and down. Somebody may say, oh, these guys with all this money and these big houses and stuff, that looks like a much more interesting life than my simple, happy life. Maybe I'll try that out. And I don't think you can have one answer for that. And as far as, you know, I come to the mode of goodness through knowledge, and I can, you know, it seems like a circle. It seems like you can't break into it. But you start with where you are. It's always like that. You know, I start serving Krishna with some devotion, and by serving Krishna, I get more devotion, and I use that to serve Krishna more, which gives me more devotion. And how do you start? Goodness is the natural condition of the soul. Goodness is really our default value. Going up is our nature. Well, isn't that hard to start if you want to? It may not feel like that when you're in material consciousness. It may feel like you're swimming upstream and going against the current, especially in modern society, where the mode of passion or even ignorance is the default value. But as far as our real nature, our nature is to be in goodness. So starting it really is not that difficult. That makes sense? Mm-hmm. Just something else? Yes, isn't it?
They really think they know everything.
That's what Prabhupada says about people in the mode of goodness. He says that's the problem, people in the mode of goodness. That's exactly what he says. Right? He said, repeatedly, one may become a philosopher, a scientist, or a poet, and repeatedly become entangled in the same disadvantages of birth and death, but due to the illusion of the material energy, one thinks that that sort of life is pleasant. They think they already have superior knowledge. They think they're already free from sin. I mean, we run into this sometimes with people in the mode of passion who think that they're already very righteous. I'm a religious, righteous person. I don't need spirituality. I'm a good person in the world. Like Bill Gates, he said, I could do a lot more for the world on a Sunday than go to church. He's a really good example. He's a big philanthropist. And I don't know what percentage of his wealth he's giving to charity, but it's some incredible percentage, like 80 or 90% of his wealth he's giving to charity. Of course, living on 10% of Bill Gates' wealth is still, you're still a very, very wealthy person. But the point is, he thinks that he's more of a righteous person by giving to charity than by praying to God. And the mode of person, the mode of goodness, they think, yeah, I'm happy, I'm satisfied. What do I need? And the more they're in goodness, the more they're going to feel that way. It's not ultimate truth, no. But they have enough of the truth that they're feeling somewhat satisfied with that. I mean, I think we all experience that, that sometimes we make some progress in Krishna consciousness and we think, okay, that's good enough. I'm not going to do any more right now. What is that tendency? Yeah, sometimes those people are very hard to preach to. And usually you can just tell them how spiritual they are. And how people like them with their advanced spirituality and understanding will certainly appreciate Krishna consciousness. You have to do that with materialistic people in general. I mean, to a large extent, you better even do it with the devotees. Tell people how wonderful they are. That's what Prabhupada did. Prabhupada was talking to his disciples, you know, in the early days of the movement, telling them how spiritual they were and how devoted to Krishna they were. And you know, you read Prabhupada's letters, and I mean, sometimes he was really we're telling people they were total nonsenses, but generally he didn't do that. He'd say, Krishna's so satisfied with your service, you're definitely going to go back to Godhead just by doing the service for Krishna. I'm so glad that you're understanding the philosophy and that you're loving Krishna more and more. That's the way he would talk. So when you're dealing with individuals, mostly you need to do that. People can't. How many of us can really hear the truth from another person directly, one-on-one? Rare. Very rare. Prabhupada often talks about preaching by flattering people. It's also true. They are more advanced than the general mass of people. I mean, yeah, it's true. Did you have something that you wanted to share with us or something you wanted to ask?
We answered my question.
Oh, well, that's good.
And then I had something on that, but it's a little bit further on. I'll double check.
Oh, well, then wait till next week. Did you have something, Vicky? Yes. So sattva means goodness, it also means truth. Raja means passion, also means color. Things become colored. You don't see things clearly. Generally, material world means passion. The dominant mode in the material world is passion. And the dominant mode of human beings is passion. The dominant mode of animals is ignorance. The dominant mode of the demigods and the angels and the Gandharvas is goodness. And the dominant mode of human beings is passion. If they're in total goodness, yes, they have no passion and no ignorance. If you're in total goodness, you're completely pure. Then you're not material. So if we say this is a person in the mode of goodness, that means general, their general tendency is goodness. It doesn't mean 100%. Because, as Prabhupada is explaining here, that person tends to become proud. And they tend to want to keep their position. Remember, the person in the mode of passion is always trying to improve their position. The person in the mode of goodness is not so much interested in trying to improve their position. They're satisfied with their position. They're satisfied. They're happy. And they're usually a little proud. I'm fine. I'm great. Life is great. So that's some influence of passion there. Yes, I'm great. so it's not pure. I mean, you'll be rare to find somebody where all of their activities and everything they're doing is in goodness. That's going to be unusual. You'll find some. And we're trying, as devotees, we're trying to have a lifestyle that's in the mode of goodness. That's what we're aiming for in our lifestyle. Because even though it has some disadvantages, overall it's the most advantageous. Is that all right? Is there something else?
Yes, in relation about Lila Mayu's question and also the sixth text.
Okay.
Yeah, because actually, how is it possible, how can we reach to these people in goodness, you know? Because sometimes you see some nice people in the material point of view, but yeah, because they think, oh, I have all the truths, and people's egos, is so huge. And they, because are polite people, sometimes look like
they're interested,
but not hearing.
Yes.
But you see, wow, these people is nice, and you can make the body, but sometimes it's so far, it's more far than people in ignorance.
Well, people in ignorance and passion are much more feeling that they're suffering. If you're going to preach about how the material world is suffering, that's going to resonate much more with somebody in the mode of ignorance or someone in the mode of passion, because they're feeling the suffering more. A person, the more you are in goodness, the less you're feeling that it's suffering. That's why, although you can go back to Godhead from the heavenly planets, it doesn't usually happen, because the demigods there, they don't feel the... We were reading that before. Remember in the 13th chapter, seeing the evil of birth, death, old age, and disease? So someone in the mode of goodness, they're not perceiving it that much because they're not so sinful. But you can, what's the benefit of the mode of goodness? Capitalize on the benefit of that. The benefit is they do see things in relationship to God. They do see things that are truth. They can't see how there's a lot of suffering in the world.
How can we reach more type of people if are not accept as like
if someone doesn't accept, they don't accept. What can you do? It's always voluntary. But you want to find the points of agreement. You definitely want to find the points of agreement. A lot of times you can engage people who are very much interested in goodness and service. You can often get them to do a lot of service. You can often get them to agree to distribute prasadam when they have functions. Most of them will really like prasadam. I mean, sometimes they'll agree to participate in kirtan. They may agree to, you know, if you're starting a farm project, they may agree to help with that. I mean, if you're doing some things, they may agree to help. They may see that there's some connection between us and them in terms of their goals. And if they get involved in service, they'll start to get a higher taste. They'll start to see that serving Krishna is a higher pleasure than just material goodness. I mean, mostly, you're going to how do we really convince anybody? Pratyekshavagamam dharma. It's going to be through experience. It's not through intellectualism. No one's ever convinced of anything, ultimately, just intellectually, ever. Even, you know, to buy a new watch or whatever we're doing, there's some emotion involved. It's not just intellectual. So the main way we convince people to take up Krishna consciousness is by somehow or other getting them to have some experience of Krishna consciousness. That's really our preaching. Intellectual conviction is very nice. But that's not really how any of us took up Krishna consciousness. Even hearing the philosophy and accepting the philosophy, because the philosophy has to do with Krishna. When you're hearing about Krishna, you make Krishna happy. The happiness we feel in studying the philosophy is not just intellectual. It was experiencing something spiritual. Even if you say, you know, I came because of the philosophy, it was a spiritual experience. That you read the books, or you heard something, and you go, wow, does that ever make sense? That was an intellectual thing. That wasn't like all of a sudden understanding the quadratic formula in calculus class. That was getting a glimpse of truth. It was getting a glimpse of God. So that's the main way you're going to have people take up Krishna consciousness. Get them to do some service. Get them to put them in a position where they're likely to experience Krishna. So how are they going to do that? Get them to give some money. Get them to touch the book. Get them to look at the book. Get them to read the book. Get them to appreciate the picture in the book. Get them to have some prasadam. Get them to hear the kirtan. Something. And a person who's receptive, when they experience that, if they have some desire and some receptivity, then Krishna, who's within the heart, gets so happy that they're doing that, that he's reciprocating with them, and they start feeling that Krishna's pleased. And then they feel happiness that's a different quality than they've ever felt before. And they go, whoa, what was that? I want more of that. Just like when I was a teenager, my friends and I would drive 45 minutes each way to go to a particular restaurant that had a particular kind of cheesecake. And you taste it once, and then, you know, you just... Nobody else made cheesecake that good. And we would go there again and again and again, even though it was way out of the way. And it was a lot of trouble. So once, Nardamuni says, once you taste Krishna consciousness, you can't forget it. It's extraordinary. Now, what allows some people, when they contact Krishna consciousness, to taste it and some people not to taste it? That depends on their receptivity. That's not something you can control. But at least you can give them the opportunity. But that's the main way to convince anybody. You're not convincing them. They're convincing themselves. Krishna's convincing them. I can't convince anybody. So that's our real preaching. Somehow to put people in touch with Krishna. Some people to somehow connect with Krishna, connect with Krishna, connect with Krishna, somehow or other. Did you have something that you wanted to share or that you wanted to ask? Yeah, it said unlimited. And the acharyas describe all the different reasons why Krishna might have closed his eyes. Yeah. Okay. With the airport. You got to get on the plane.
Yeah, how, like, it seems so simple, but...
How do you do that? That's our whole process of bhakti yoga, is how you do that. You know, by chanting, by reading books, that gradually you... What is it? You have to develop a desire. I mean, what you're talking about, the difficulty with people in the mode of goodness, or anybody, is they don't have the desire. They think, I'm happy where I am. Whether you're happy where you are by being a heroin addict, or whether you're happy where you are by... you know, being some businessman who's always trying to make more and more money to get a bigger and bigger car, or whether you're happy where you are because you're just happy and satisfied and you're living a peaceful life, studying science and philosophy and poetry. You know, it's the desire. How do you get the desire? Ultimately, the only way you get the desire is by the mercy of the devotee. That's also explained in Madhurya Kadambini, that because Krishna is neutral, but the devotees, they go out and preach. And there's some contact with the devotee may spark the desire in your heart. And why in some people and not others? How can you explain that? I don't think there's an explanation for that. But some people, when they contact the devotee, that desire sparks. And once it sparks, then you got to fan it. So that's our process, fanning the desire until it becomes a flame, until it gets back to the original flame. Fanning, 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 fanning. Everything we're doing should be increasing our desire to make Krishna happen. Until nista, it's a hard struggle with determination. Sorry. And until nista means that we're, what that means when we're not at nista, it means we're very much conditioned by passion ignorance. That there's a big influence of passion ignorance in our life. Once we're steadily in goodness, things are very easy and fast. But getting to be steadily in goodness is difficult. It takes a struggle. It's a hard struggle with determination. It's hard. You know, but that's the mess we got ourselves into. It's nobody's fault but ours. What to say? If someone is already situated strongly in goodness, and again, there aren't very many people like that, but if someone strongly situated in goodness takes up spiritual life for them, it'd be very easy. Once they take it up, it's very easy. The struggle is the our attachment to passion and ignorance. And the struggle is our attachment to passion and ignorance. And we're attached to passion and ignorance because we want to forget Krishna. So gradually get the desire to want to remember Krishna. Hear about him, and oh, he's a wonderful guy. Hear the philosophy, wow, this philosophy is wonderful. Krishna's wonderful. Krishna's devotees are wonderful. Krishna's prasadam is wonderful. Preaching is wonderful. And after a while, you say, yeah, I really want to do this. And the fears and the attachments start going away. Can you do that in a moment? Yeah, in theory. In practice, it's not usually a moment. Practice is usually more than one life. Sorry. Is that all right? Definitely we can go back to God in one lifetime. That means one lifetime from beginning to end. So for most of us, first of all, this is not our first lifetime. I once gave class at New Vrindavan, maybe 400 devotees. I said, how many of you have evidence that you probably practiced Krishna consciousness to some extent in a previous life? And 90% of the devotees raised their hand. I'd say that probably most of us have some evidence that this is not our first lifetime in spiritual life. So this probably isn't one life anyway. This may already be life number 10 that we're trying to become spiritually enlightened. But can you go from 0 to 100 in one life? Yes, Prabhupada says you have to be as determined as Dhruva Maharaj to do that. Is it possible? Yes. Do most people do it in one lifetime? No. It's very unusual. For most of us, it takes many lives. Can we do it in this lifetime? Sure. Why not? Will most people do it in this lifetime? No. Can you? Yes. Of course you can. You got to be willing to go through the hard struggle with determination. You got to be willing to do it. We do it for so many things in the world, for goodness sakes. If you don't do a hard struggle with determination to get to the point of goodness, you're going to do a hard struggle with determination to stay in the material world. It's not that if I give up Krishna consciousness and I'm a materialist, there won't be a hard struggle with determination. Life will just be easy. That's nonsense. How many people do you know that say, oh yeah, life is just easy? I don't know very many people like that. If you want to have a happy marriage, you have to work at it. If you want to have good kids, you have to work at it. If you want to have a clean house, you have to work at it. It's work. If you want to have good health, you have to work at it. Right? What do you not have to work at? And all those things are temporary and fleeting and not fully satisfying. Whereas with Krishna consciousness, you do come to a point where it's no longer a hard struggle with determination. You do come to a point where it's natural and it's easy and it's just fast and gliding. Can you do that all in one life? Definitely. Do we know people who are successful in one life? Definitely. Will most people do it? No. That's my experience. Most people will not do it in one life. They reach a certain point and they say, this is too much. I'm not doing this anymore. I'll do some. I'll still go to the temple. I'll offer my food. Maybe I'll still chant my rounds. But I'll go to the movies and I'll, you know, eat this and that and whatever. That's what we see generally. People reach a point where they say, okay, I'm not ready to surrender more. And then sometimes after 10 years, they say, okay, now I'm going to go on. It's up to you. It's up to each of us. Bhakti Siddhanta Sarasvati and commenting on the verse Karma Adinirjahati Kintuja Bhakti Bhajam. There's no karma for the devotees. He said the devotees' karma is burned up in the fire of ordeal. Fire of ordeal. Gotta be willing to go through the fire of ordeal. You're gonna go through it anyway. You're gonna go through fires of ordeal anyway if you're a materialist. Why not do it for a spiritual purpose? But you know, sometimes devotees get to a certain fire of ordeal and they go, oh no! Not gonna go through that. Mm-hmm. Yeah, go through it anyway, Hare Krishna. At a certain point you say, I'm going through the fire of ordeal anyway, I might as well do it for Krishna. I wish somebody had talked to me like this when I was early in the movement, which is why I talk to you guys like this. I wish somebody had prepared me. I mean, it's there in the Shastra, and Prabhupada says it, but somehow I wasn't really prepared. And when you hit those things and you think, wait a minute, this is, spiritual life isn't supposed to be like this. Yes, it is. You know, if you've got gold that's mixed with other things, you've got to put it through the fire. You know, if you've been rolling in the mud, you got to take a shower. And if you haven't taken a shower for, you know, a month, then maybe you got to get a scrub brush too. But boy, do you feel good when you get out of the shower. I'm just thinking of, please excuse me for using this example, but you know, I was a Gurukul teacher for like 20-something years, almost 30 years. So we had all these children's books in the school. And of course, there's not enough Krishna conscious books, so I would try to choose books that were at least supportive. Anyway, so we had the C.S. Lewis's Narnia books there. And one of the parts I really, really like is this boy who goes kind of against his will. He gets sucked into going on this journey. And the whole time, all he's doing is complaining and criticizing everybody and just basically just being really obnoxious. So they get to this island, and he wanders off by himself without telling anybody where he's going. And he ends up finding a stack of treasure, gold and jewels and stuff. And he's, you know, interested in this treasure. And he takes one of the armlets, and he puts it on his arm. But what he doesn't realize is it's the treasure of a dragon. And by wearing the treasure of a dragon, he turns into a dragon. So he turns into a dragon, and at that point, and when he does that, the armlet on his arm becomes too tight, and it's really hurting his arm. And he starts to be sorry now that he's a dragon. He goes back to all the other people. He can't talk to them anymore, and he can't communicate with them anymore. And all of a sudden, he starts seeing that he was really that they weren't nasty, that he was the one who was nasty. He starts getting a desire to reform, right? So as he increases and increases and increases in his desire to reform, at one point, he meets the character C.S. Lewis has as God or Jesus, who's this lion. So he says, you know, I don't want to be a dragon anymore. I want to be a little boy again. I want to be my real self. So the lion says, okay, here's some water, some pure spiritual water. You go bathe in there. So he goes bathing there. You know how lizards can take off their skin? So he bathes in there, and he keeps taking off his skin. But as he takes off his skin, there's more and more and more underneath. No matter how many times he takes it off, there's still more. So at one point, the lion says, okay, I'll do it for you. But when he does it, he takes out his claws. And you know how cats, they can velvet their claws? They can put the claws inside their hand or take it out. So he takes out the claws. And, you know, the claws of a lion are like, you know, we say Lord Nisingadevi has thunderbolt nails. So he takes these claws and he rips the lion, the dragon form off this boy. And as he's doing it, C.S. Lewis described that it was very painful, he said, but it was the most wonderful kind of pain in the world. And then after ripping off the dragon form, he tells him to bathe in the water, and it said the water kind of stung because he had new skin on, but it was also very delightful. It was a delightful, refreshing kind of, you know, put something on your skin that's like bracing. And then there he was in his original form again, and he was a changed person. So it's very much like that. You know, we become entangled in the world, and we are greedy for things, and then we take on a dragon body. You know, we take on this material body that's covering our real self. And at a certain point, we just say, you know, I don't like this. I'm suffering. And we try to clean ourselves, and we try to clean ourselves. We try to purify. At a certain point, we submit ourselves to Krishna and say, okay, just do whatever you want to do. At a certain point, you say it and you mean it. As I've said many times before, if you say it before you mean it, you'll find that out. But at a certain point, you say it and you mean it. You say, okay, doctor, just do whatever you want. Just do whatever you want to do. I just want to be clean now. And yeah, it'll hurt a little bit, but it'll be such a wonderful thing. So until we're at that point, it's a hard struggle with determination. It doesn't seem like we're getting much of anywhere. We clean off one layer, and there's another, and there's another, and there's another, and there's another. At a certain point, we actually surrender and say, okay, Lord, you know, from this day on, I was just reading Chaitanya Mahaprabhu said it, this is nothing goes wrong. From this day on, I'm yours. Says from that point, you know, I take personal charge of a person. So that said, it's to some degree at an immature stage. But when we really fully say it with heartfelt feeling, when we really mean it, I trust you, Lord. Whatever you want to do with me is okay. If it hurts, it hurts. But you know, I was just at Agahanta and Rajeshwari's house last night for prasadam, and their daughter has an infection on her finger, and so she had to take this medicine. So she's there at prasadam time, and they put this little medicine next to her plate. As soon as they put it out, she had a complete fit. No! Just exactly like that. I don't want to! I don't like the way it tastes! You know, and they said, well, you can't get any more prasadam until you take your medicine. So she walked away from the table, and she washed her hands, and she said, I'm not taking any. And I said, well, Veda Priya, we could cut off your finger if you don't want to take the medicine. You know, she's really thinking about this whole thing. And after a while, it took maybe like 10, 15 minutes. After a while, she comes back. Can I have another one of this? After you take your medicine. I don't want to take my medicine. Look at that thumb, Veda Priya. It looks really bad. And after a while, she said, well, I'll just take a little. You know, so she takes it and she takes just one sip. And her father says, well, I don't know how many sips it'll be. A few sips. Just three? I don't know. A few sips. She takes one, you know, and then she's trying to spill it out. You know, she's going through all these things. Finally, she drank it. And when she finally drank it, it's really interesting. She took the container and she started licking the container. And then she even went to the refrigerator and got the whole bottle and said, I want more. So it's exactly like we fight and we scream. And it's so hard, Krishna consciousness is so hard. How am I going to come to goodness? No! All right, I'll take a little bit. Oh, okay, no more. I'll take a little bit. Okay, that's enough, that's enough, that's enough. Oh, it tastes so bad. Oh, no. Oh, I want the dessert. Okay. And my thumb's really hurting. All right. And then you take it and you go, wow, this is sweet stuff. Can I have some more? So yes, you can do it in this life. I don't know if I'll make it in this life. Gopi Pranandaprabhu once said to me, why does it have to be this life? He said, you try your best to make it this life and you leave it up to Krishna, what he wants to do. When he said that, I was like, whoa. That was too much surrender for me. I want it now. Oh, maybe the master teacher thinks I'll be better off in another situation. I don't know. That's his business. But I shouldn't have it be another life because I'm a nonsense. All right? At least on my part, do my best. Expedite things. So yes, you have some question or something you wanted to share? Then things would be very easy, yes.
Yeah, like, quite
yes. The more that you're situated in the mode of goodness, the easier Krishna consciousness is. Yes. That's it's very nice if you can do that. It's rare. It's rare. Most of us have too much contamination of passion and ignorance. But if you're already situated very much in goodness, it's much easier. It's not that there's nothing, you know, you still have to deal with the false ego and the pride, and but it's much easier.
Right.
Yeah, all of our material attachments are like that.
Yeah.
We scream and cry about them, and then once they're actually dealt with, then we're like, why did I wait for 10 years to deal with that?
And so, like, when you can do that, like, you take the plunge and push yourself a little bit further. Like, is it that desire?
Yes. That's desire, that's faith. It's all the things we've been talking about. That's fearlessness. It's faith. It means I trust Krishna. You trusted your spiritual master. He said you need to get rid of this cat. You didn't want to do it, but you trusted him. You trusted him that he's giving you an instruction that's for your benefit. And he said it'll be easy. And so you had some faith. You didn't have 100% faith, otherwise you wouldn't have been crying. But you had faith. And you did it and you found out, oh, that worked. Wow, I did it and my world didn't collapse. It wasn't terrible. I feel peaceful. And as you get those experiences, then you do them more and more and more. Then it becomes not just with cats, it becomes with, you know, your internal lust and anger and envy and greed. You know, at the time that you're doing it with the cat, it seemed like the most horrific thing to do in the world. It seemed like your biggest material attachment. And right? And then a few years later, it seems almost humorous. It's like, how could I have been so attached to a cat? And in the same way, you know, the great souls, they look at our attachments and think, you know, how foolish.
No. I was just gonna, like, no way. I can't do that. And before I probably would have been like,
oh, you need to take care of the puppy. God, once at our school, somebody drove up to our school, our devotee school, which meant driving off the road and all the way up the driveway, and dropped off a mother dog and her, what was it, 4 or 5 puppies. Opened the door, dropped them off, and drove off. And I think one of the puppies just ran off somewhere. We never found it. Now, I would have just let the dogs run off. We lived in a country, a rural area. You know, there were woods all around. And if I had been there when it happened, I would have said to the kids, just leave the dogs alone. Let them go find their own place. But I wasn't. And some of the students were there, and they took the mother dog and I forget how many puppies, some, at least one of them ran off. And they brought it into the deck of the building. And they wouldn't let them go. That was a whole scene. So then finally, the GBC there finally said, well, all right, now that you've given them shelter, you can't just put them out. You're going to have to find a home for them. So that was a whole thing. We couldn't find any no-kill shelter. All the no-kill shelters were full. Finally, what we did was my son and I took all the dogs out to the local town on a Saturday morning with a big sign. These dogs were abandoned at our school. Please give them a home. Thank you, Krishna. Somebody came and got each of the dogs. That was a whole scene.
I felt bad about it, but it was kind of like Krishna's our dog rather than people.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But you found it was easier, you know. Yeah, getting rid of the cat was heart-wrenching and saying no to the dog was easy. You said, no, I'm not going to take this dog. Yeah, if that lady had pulled up and said, would you take these dogs? I would have said, no, thank you. You have to deal with your dogs yourself. Anyway, it'll be like that with all of our attachments, sooner or later. Did you have some question or something you wanted to share? No? Yes. False ego is the sense that I am separate from Krishna. Well, false ego manifests according to the modes of material nature. In mode of goodness, it's I am separate from Krishna, but I am happy and satisfied and peaceful. I'm a philosopher, I'm a scientist, I'm a teacher, I'm a truth seeker. And that way I can be happy in the world. And the mode of passion, it's I'm a doer. I'm a creator. I'm the friend of everyone. I can help everyone. It's covered with one of those modes. Real ego is I am Krishna's servant. I am Krishna's beloved. That's real ego. Subal and Vishakha, and they have real ego, Yasoda. Nanda Maharaj is thinking, I am Nanda Maharaj. I am Krishna's father. That's his real ego. That's his real self. And here I'm thinking, I am Susie Smith. I am a, whatever. I am Susie Smith, and I'm from Croatia, and this is the kind of person I am, and this is how I... That's all false ego. The essential part of false ego is that I am the controller, I am the enjoyer, I am the center. I am is not false, but I am the controller, and I am the center, and I am the enjoyer. That is false. I am the servant and beloved of Krishna. That is true. Well, the sense of false ego is one of the material elements. It's a kind of covering over the soul. No. If you're in pure goodness, you're not covered by the elements at all. They're there, but they're not covering you. let's say you're in a drama. So to be in a drama, you're covered by makeup and a costume. But you're also covered by the character that you're playing. So you're acting as if you're that character. Now, if to play in a drama, you usually have to practically believe that you are that character. But if you're playing in a drama and you don't believe you're that character, if you continue the sense of who you are, then you're not really covered by the costume and the makeup and the character. Superficially you are, but actually you're not. But if you start believing that you're that character, then you're covered. Then that character's personality and makeup and costume are covering you. You've forgotten who you are. The play's over and you go off stage and you still act like you're the character. So that's false ego. If you have real ego, then you're not covered. Even if you're apparently covered, you're not covered. It's not affecting you. You're not identifying with it. But in material goodness, there's still false ego. Because material goodness is still contaminated by passion and ignorance. It's not pure goodness. You know, in one sense, all there is consciousness. So we're talking about degrees of covering. So if there's a lot of covering, we call it ignorance. Less covering, we call it passion. Less covering, we call it goodness. How you could say how clear the covering is. How clear the covering over one's consciousness is. So in goodness, the covering over one's consciousness is clearer. Okay, something like those windows. Look at those windows over there. So you've got transparent and translucent. So transparent is clear. Translucent, the sun's still coming through, but it's not clear. Now let's say we took that translucent means, lucent means light. Trans means going through. The light is going through, but you don't get a clear image. All you see is light. Then we could have something that covered more. Let's say I put a red tint on that window. Now let's say I cover the window with the curtain. So the clear, transparent, that's spiritual. The translucent, that's goodness. If I had translucent, that was a color, that would be passion. And if I pull the curtain over it, that's ignorance. Even if you pull the curtain over it, the curtain's not 100% opaque. There's probably some light that still comes through the curtain. 100% opaque, you're talking about matter. So that you won't find a living entity generally that's 100% in the mode of ignorance. So light's still coming through, but it's still covered. So in the material mode of goodness, there's still some covering. But still we're distinguishing. All right? Okay, thank you very much. All glories to Srila Prabhupada. Mm-hmm.